and welcome to Let's Talk, a podcast where I interview professionals for their takes on mental health, addiction, and current events. My name is Dr. Aaron Weiner, a psychologist, addiction specialist, and a guy who is irrepressibly interested in learning about the human condition. I'm your host for Let's Talk, and I hope you'll join me as I explore psychology, medicine, public policy, and how mental health factors into just about everything. My guest for today is Dr. Molly Bodring. Dr. Bodring is a clinical scholar and postdoctoral researcher in the Stanford Prevention Research Center, a clinician at Stanford's Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic, and the author of several recently published peer-reviewed articles on non-alcoholic beverages. I'm incredibly excited to have Dr. Bodring on the show because I had recently made a post on LinkedIn about non-alcoholic beverages and some of my anecdotal experiences working with folks in clinic around these, and just had gotten such a diverse range of opinions from folks who felt like they were useful, some who were very opposed to them for folks in recovery, and realized I don't know very much about the science behind non-alcoholic beverages, beers, mocktails, wines, etc. So I reached out to a colleague who referred me over to Dr. Bodring and had just a fantastic discussion where I learned a tremendous amount about the beverages themselves, the policies surrounding them, the data we have on their utility. I know I got a lot out of it. I think you will too. So thanks as always for listening in, and I hope you enjoy the conversation. Dr. Molly Bodring, thanks so much for joining me today on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so I reached out because I was seeing some news articles about non-alcoholic beverages, which is going to be our main topic for today. And as someone who's very involved in the addiction psychology community and addiction recovery community, I know that this has always been a really hot button topic about, like, how should we be thinking about these products? How should we be understanding them? What use do they have? Should we or should we be recommending people towards or away against them? And so hopefully today we'll be able to really dive in and root around and all that sort of information and those sort of questions. But in terms of getting the conversation started, maybe you could just help us all understand, what exactly is a non-alcoholic beverage? Are they all the same fundamentally? Are there some differences? How should we understand them?
Yeah, so there are definitely some differences. So I'll kind of describe what I think of when I'm talking about non-alcoholic beverages. So I typically am referring to non-alcoholic beers, non-alcoholic wines, non-alcoholic liquor or spirits, as well as mocktails, which would be mixed drinks that mirror a cocktail but don't induce intoxication in the same way. What I can say is the United States Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, defines a non-alcoholic beer or non-alcoholic wine as having 0.5% alcohol by volume, which is compared to a standard beer, which would be about 5%, or a standard glass of wine, which would be about 12%. To your question about are they all the same, the answer is no in terms of how they're made. So some of them are made without any alcohol from the get-go, which means they end up with an alcohol by volume of 0.0% or something close to that. Whereas others initially have alcohol in them, and then they're de-alcoholized through different types of processes until they reach that threshold of 0.5%. So hopefully that paints a little bit of a picture of the products that we're talking about.
Yeah, well, it does. And I know that differentiation between the, like, true zero, because when we hear non-alcoholic, it makes you think, okay, well, there's no alcohol in here, versus a little bit, for many people functionally wouldn't make too much of a difference. Although I know that there's some folks who are saying, going for that very, we'll call it traditional style, like, what does it mean to be sober? What does it mean to be in recovery? And they see that and it kind of makes them a little bit leery and think, man, well, so what does it mean if I'm like, does it count? Is it a problem? That sort of thing. I mean, from your perspective, like functionally, you know, is 0.05% meaningful in any way?
So I think you're going to get different answers from different people, but from my perspective, 0.5% is an amount of alcohol that we actually see naturally occurring in some fruit juices even. So even if you were to drink a few non-alcoholic beverages in the course of one occasion, you're very unlikely to experience intoxication in the way that you would with one beer or one standard wine, for example. So from the standpoint of, is this going to lead to intoxication from this consumption? Probably not. But then there are concerns that we do have about it containing a lot of alcohol-related cues, which can contribute to craving and might then lead to consumption. So it's a complicated question. So in some cases, not an issue. In other cases, yeah.
Yeah, well, and we'll dig around a bit in that soon. So here's the question then about that. So what in your mind are the use cases for non-alcoholic beverages of different types? I know that more recently, right, there's been, I feel like, a lot of buzz around things like Dry January. We've seen a lot of news briefs from different public health agencies about how no amount of alcohol is positive for your health, and maybe even, you know, certain amounts that previously thought of being safe actually have been associated with all-cause mortality and other problems. And so I feel like there's been a push towards them more recently, just amongst those who are more health conscious. But from your standpoint, what's been the trajectory of non-alcoholic beverages, and when should we think about either working them in or switching to them, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I think you're getting at kind of the consumer perspective, where a lot of people have been reevaluating their relationship to alcohol. And we can think about the sober curiosity movement, which kind of started in the past decade or so, where it's referring to people, taking a look at their relationship to alcohol and maybe thinking about reducing or abstaining. And when somebody chooses to reduce or abstain, it's really important to actually find an alternative behavior or experience to replace that drinking experience. And for a lot of people, they might turn to non-alcoholic beverages to drink those with friends instead of drinking alcohol with friends. So it kind of can be the substitute experience. What I can speak to is a study that I conducted recently with my advisor, Jody Prochaska, at the Stanford Prevention Research Center, along with Dennis McCarthy at University of Missouri and Catherine Fairbairn at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where we surveyed people who consumed alcohol and also consumed non-alcoholic beverages. And we gave them a list of about 20 reasons why they might consume non-alcoholic beverages. And the top five that came out were not wanting the negative effects of alcohol, like a hangover, feeling like non-alcoholic beverages are better for their health than alcohol, being curious about the beverages, liking the taste of non-alcoholic beverages, and then fifth, not wanting to continue drinking alcohol, so trying to reduce or abstain. So a lot of these are tapping into that health and wellness oriented goal of wanting to feel better and maybe cut back on the alcohol use.
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting when we talk about a product like alcohol, right? Because it's so, from a public health perspective, actual like alcoholic beverages have been so destructive. I mean, I know there's an infographic shared by NIAAA recently that really resonated with me, like really caught my eye, about, I think it's about 170,000 alcohol-related deaths a year. And when you compare that to drug overdoses, it actually eclipses it by quite a large amount, although we don't think about it in the same way. And I think a lot of it just has to do with those social pressures, right? And when there are folks who are not necessarily identifying as having an alcohol use disorder or alcoholism or, you know, anything along those lines, but they're thinking like, maybe, although I've been socialized to think like, oh, I should be drinking this in certain situations, or I need to be doing this if my friends are doing it, like maybe actually there would be some benefit of swapping some of just the alcohol part out. They're not going for intoxication. It's more of like a social pressure thing.
Absolutely. And I think what gets complicated, though, is we think about how these beverages are marketed. And so there's kind of this issue of, are they marketed as a substitute beverage, where instead of alcohol, you're now drinking a non-alcoholic beverage, and that should have really positive public health impacts. Alternatively, there are some addition marketing approaches that are also being used, where marketers are saying, use these non-alcoholic beverages in contexts where alcohol typically is not consumed. So one study by Emily Nichols that came out last year found evidence of these types of marketing tactics, where they're saying, use non-alcoholic beverages at the gym, at work, while you're driving. And the concern that kind of comes up around that is it might reinforce kind of the amount of context that we should be having alcohol or alcohol-related products, kind of reinforcing the ubiquity of alcohol across our day-to-day experiences. And so, yeah, we're really wrestling with this. Is it a substitute or is it an additive product across context? That's a little bit of an issue.
Wow, that's a really interesting point, right? Because for like from all intents and purposes, like if say you're having some sort of like non-alcoholic limeade or something like that, it tastes very similar. You know, like having had some of the more modern non-alcoholic products, like they do taste good. They taste very comparable. It's not like you're missing very much there, but at the same time, then you're starting to habituate. Like, yeah, like I'm going to be like on the elliptical drinking something that could be alcoholic or something like that. Maybe that's not a behavioral pattern that you would be in our best interest to normalize.
Absolutely. And I think it continues to normalize or rather familiarize people with the brands of full strength products, since many alcohol distributors are now making non-alcoholic counterparts to their beverages. And so you're seeing those brands more and more often, which might have a negative impact as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. Getting more people to drink who in situations or who otherwise might not have. Is it legal to drive with a non-alcohol? Like if it's one of those ones that has 0.05, like what is the open, do you know the open container law? Like that one, when you said that really took me aback for a second there.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Off the top of my head, I don't have a definitive answer. I think it might vary state by state. So we might need to look into that after we get off the call.
Yeah, well, that makes some sense actually that states would determine that. But yeah, like if that's actually being encouraged, do you know off the top of your head what that study found from your colleague about those contexts, like what the major findings were?
So having read the paper, I think the key takeaways that I took from it were one, that these addition marketing tactics are definitely being used. But the researchers surveyed consumers' perceptions of the tactics, and by and large, they found that consumers were resistant to that type of addiction marketing and were really conveying that, no, the way that I use non-alcoholic beverages is as a substitute. It is to try to reduce alcohol rather than to have it come across in new contexts and new experiences, which is encouraging.
Yeah, let's pretend. I see what you're doing. It's like we're on to you. Like I see what you're trying to do there. I'm trying to associate it. You know what that reminds me of? I saw a reference to another paper recently that was talking about an industry tactic of pinking. So making beverages and turning them pink in an effort to appeal more to women. And actually how that was not always necessarily successful either. Some people were finding it basically as like patronizing, like, oh, you're going to color it pink, so I'm going to like it. Well, you know, screw you. That's awfully stereotypical. So like those sorts of approaches, I think, can backfire sometimes too.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, so in terms then about this idea of substitution, so we started today, and again, I know that the big elephant in the room is around this question of like, so people who identify as having alcoholism or an alcohol use disorder, how should they look at these products? I know actually what really spurred me on to having this conversation with you today was I saw, I think it was a journal article published about non-alcoholic beverages, and I had just posted on LinkedIn saying like, hey, so like, what's everyone's experiences with this? I know for me, I've been working with some clients who have used them, and it has not precipitated like a full relapse or resumption of use at their previous rate. And they've been stable in terms of meeting their goals of not drinking like true alcoholic beverages. And it was very interesting to see the results of just who responded to that and what they said. There were a lot of people with very strong opinions either way. And so I was wondering from your perspective, like what's your take or what does the evidence say around people with use disorders having non-alcoholic beverages? How concerned should we be? Is it okay? Or how should we look at it?
Yeah, so I can speak to this both from a research perspective and clinically. So from a research perspective, there have not been a ton of studies looking at this question. So we just don't have enough evidence to make a blanket statement about whether non-alcoholic beverages are helpful or harmful for people with alcohol use disorder. I can speak about this study that I referenced earlier that I recently conducted. And we found that among people who were at risk for alcohol use disorder, about a third said that because they drink non-alcoholic beverages, their desire for alcohol decreases. And then about two-thirds said that because they drink non-alcoholic beverages, they feel like they are drinking less alcohol, which is actually really important and pretty encouraging. The flip side of that is about 10%, I want to say, said that it led to increased desire for alcohol, and about 3%, so small, but still there, about 3% said it led to increased alcohol consumption. Now that's one study, it's a limited sample, right, so we need more research, but it's pointing to the variability across people, that I think even within a group of people who have alcohol use disorder, there are going to be some who find these helpful and some who find these harmful. And that mirrors my clinical experience as well, working with folks who struggle with alcohol use disorder, where some are able to have a mocktail at a bar with friends who are drinking full strength alcohol, and they're able to maintain their recovery. Whereas others, when they try to drink a mocktail or non-alcoholic beer, they find themselves slipping back into drinking the full strength counterpart.
Mm-hmm. So again, I understand we're still very early on in terms of our empirical understanding of these subjects, but I'm wondering, so what factors should we be thinking about, aside from just, say, someone's reaction to it, in terms of how they should approach it? Have you either noticed something about what seems to either predispose folks to just having a negative reaction to drinking non-alcoholic products, or factors that make it seem like it would be a successful intervention or something to substitute in?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the biggest thing that comes to mind for me is cue reactivity. So how does somebody respond to the cues of an alcoholic beverage, the taste, the look, the experience of drinking the brand, where for some people that can lead to really strong cravings in that moment. For other people, it might not. And so I think for people who are less cue reactive, where they can see other people drinking and not have craving arise, they can sip a non-alcoholic beverage that tastes like beer and not feel like they want to turn to the full strength beer. It seems like there could be potential utility there. But for folks who are experiencing increased craving, that is putting them at increased risk for then turning to the real thing. And so in that case, I would probably recommend folks try to stay away from the non-alcoholic beverages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like this feels like one of these moments where I feel like there's a lot of black or white binary thinking at times in the addiction recovery community, where it's either, you know, like you're sober or not, you know, like just straight up period. And so the idea that I'm just imagining, for example, that like say there's someone who's counting days, as folks oftentimes like to do. And, you know, they've got an amount of days built up that they feel really good about. And even if it seems like there might be some benefit to drinking a non-alcoholic beverage to make it through certain social situations or to be a substitute, like you were mentioning before, I can imagine there would be some people who would look at that and feel a lot of pressure to not even try because they'd be worried about the implication.
Yeah, and that's where I think it gets back to like an individual's perspective and approach to their recovery. For some people, I think having that very clear line of I'm not going to go to a bar, I'm not going to surround myself with people who are drinking, I'm not going to tempt myself by having something that tastes very similar to maybe my prior alcoholic beverage of choice. That seems like a fine line to keep if that's what's helpful for the individual. For other people, they might find a different approach is more useful. And I think it gets back to your point of it's difficult to say yes or no, to be all in or all out on this, because it's very person specific.
Right. I feel like that it always comes back to that in terms of like when we think about like what is best practice. Like it's not that there's any one thing that's good for everybody, whether or not we're talking about non-alcoholic beverages or naltrexone or cognitive behavioral therapy or Alcoholics Anonymous or whatever it is. Like there's a lot of possible benefits, right? There's a lot of things that can work. It's really just a question of like what's working for the individual. And sometimes you figure that out. You can see that ahead of time. Sometimes it's a trial and error sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so a question for you as well. So on the question of just thinking again of folks who really appreciate being alcohol free and want to stay that way, are there certain types of non-alcoholic products that they could look for in a store, or is it really just like you have to really inspect the label closely? And you know, will it say 0.0% alcohol by volume, or will just there be nothing there if it's completely alcohol free?
Yeah, good question. So there should be a specific label of the alcohol percentage. So it should be 0.0 or 0.5 if it's non-alcoholic. What I will say is there was one research study conducted back in 2010 that looked at the actual alcohol content of a number of non-alcoholic products that were labeled either 0.0 or 0.5. And they found that I think it was maybe about a third of them had a alcohol by volume that was higher than what was said on the label. So even though they said they were 0.5, they were actually above 1% alcohol by volume. Now, for some people, maybe they say, okay, 1%, 0.5%, no big deal, I'm fine either way. But for others, that actually might make a big difference in their decision making. And so yeah. I guess from that standpoint, this is where it might be helpful to instead have a homemade mocktail, maybe a club soda and lime, as opposed to turning to a prepackaged product that has been de-alcoholized, but we can't necessarily be confident it's been de-alcoholized to the threshold that it's saying it has been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll follow up on that. I'll put a link to the PubMed page for that in the show notes so that if folks would like to check it out. I mean, obviously it's been a few years since it came out. Hopefully, you know, the brands or products have been, you know, they saw the study and were like, "Ooh, we better tighten this up," and since that time. But it's true. I mean, I'm thinking as well about some folks where drug testing, even sometimes ETG testing, and for those listening who aren't aware, this is looking at a metabolite of alcohol in urine that allows you to look back a couple of days. Like that might actually have a bearing on whether or not they would choose to drink certain products if it seemed like that could trigger a positive result on a screen, even when they, you know, haven't functionally been drinking. That would be a major consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I was looking at some data, like publicly available data, where people were asking providers on an online kind of health website, will non-alcoholic beverages show up on an ETG test? And the response was unclear. So I'm really curious about that as well. We could make an educated guess, but there's not research, we don't know. And so it's reasonable for somebody to be concerned and asking that question if they have an assessment coming up.
Academics listening to this podcast, here's a publication idea. Let's find out how this works. Honestly, actually, I was recently wading through some ETG data, not to go on a tangent here, but just seeing, because they can be so sensitive. And I was actually surprised at how little data there was on like what creates false positives, because you hear a lot about that. And it seems like non-alcoholic beverages, that would be one of those areas where like we should get a little more information, given that the news article that really spurred my thoughts about this was that one that said that at Whole Foods right now, non-alcoholic beverages are the best-selling type of beer.
Wow.
Of any brand are the non-alcoholic ones, which is like, that is quite a sign of the times.
Yeah. Shifting times.
Well, so let's pivot now. We've been talking about non-alcoholic beverages in terms of their impact on health. Let's talk about a couple of special populations. How about pregnant women? This is something as well where, you know, if you're pregnant, obviously alcohol is a very, very bad thing to consume. Non-alcoholic beverages obviously are, as we've talked about, either very, very low alcohol to no alcohol. Do we have any data or recommendations about how folks who are pregnant should approach that?
Yeah, really good question. I have a paper under review right now that is kind of a commentary talking about, we don't have enough research on this. There have not been studies, to my knowledge, that have directly assessed the impact of non-alcoholic beverage consumption on pregnancy outcomes. So that being said, what we can turn to are thinking about guidelines from the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the CDC, where both of these entities say that no level of alcohol consumption is safe during pregnancy. Now, to my knowledge, they have not come out, neither of these groups have come out with a specific statement about non-alcoholic beverage consumption in pregnancy, but it might seem to follow from that recommendation that even 0.5% might be discouraged among people who are pregnant. So that's one thing to consider. We can also consider what I mentioned earlier about the labels not always being fully accurate, right? So having concern that it might not just be 0.5%, and do you want to take that risk? And then the other thing to think about is still that cue reactivity, and what impact is the non-alcoholic beverage consumption having on craving and alcohol use. So from a craving perspective, if it is helping somebody to reduce craving, maybe it's helpful. But if it's increasing craving and putting a pregnant person at risk of turning to full strength alcohol, then we would probably discourage it. So again, need more research, but those are some things to consider when thinking about this population.
Yeah, it seems like a very much like a better safe than sorry. I just from my perspective look at it, but I could also imagine that you're going to get some folks from the industry, even the non-alcoholic side, saying like, well, some fruit juices have the same amount. Why are we being discriminated against if there's no warnings against those juices?
Yeah, which is fair. And maybe that is part of why different groups have not come out and made very clear recommendations discouraging the use of these non-alcohol products. But I guess another thing we can consider is there's still caloric intake with limited nutritional value of these drinks. And in some cases, there's high sugar content. So I don't know, working with your provider to talk about what impact would those things potentially have on pregnancy, and just making sure that you're taking a well-rounded and informed approach. I think that's the big thing with these products, making sure that you are informed about what you're consuming so that your decision about consuming or not is informed.
Right. Well, and the labeling issues, that one's so huge. And actually a question on that, like I know I've read a lot of studies on different products around mislabeling, particularly completely unregulated products, thinking right now about like Delta 8, Kratom, things like that, where there's really no quality control. But even sometimes when there's supposed to be quality control around things, like in Illinois, where I am, we have a cannabis industry, and there's been tests done on those that shows not always what they say it is in terms of in the contaminants and things like that. I guess I've always assumed that like beer, when it says like actual, like fully leaded, if you will, beer, or another type of alcohol product, when it says like 5% alcohol by volume, 3, 7, whatever it is, that that's accurate. Does it seem like non-alcoholic beverages are different in that way? Kind of like, say, Delta 8, where they're not being regulated properly?
It's a good question. My understanding, and I would have to double check this, but my understanding of alcohol beverages is that the alcohol by volume that they're legally able to report, I believe, can vary a little bit. So I think it may be able to vary actually by 0.05. So a 5% beer perhaps could actually in content be 5.5 or 4.5. When we get to thinking about non-alcoholic beverages, I'm not sure if that same leeway still applies, but if it does, yeah, so 0.5 could actually be 1%. Again, I don't want to harp too much on that study I referenced earlier, but it did find that it was even greater than 1%, so outside of that margin of error range. So yeah, it's possible that regulations are not tight enough around this, or it's possible that, I don't know, the different producers are maybe not kind of staying in line in the way that they are supposed to. So maybe we need more evaluation of the consistency between labels and the actual alcohol content.
Yeah, well, it just is a very interesting point around when you get down to such small numbers, right? Like point, like even within that normal margin of error becomes literally like a doubling in alcohol content when you get down so low. And this seems like another area that's ripe for research. You know, like let's replicate that study with modern products and see what happens. But even if it is within the range, there might be some cause for saying like if we have like a non-alcoholic beverage class, like perhaps it shouldn't be 0.5%. Maybe it should be more like 0.25 or 0.1 or whatever would be a little bit tighter if you're trying to keep something low.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in the UK it is 0.05 as opposed to 0.5. And so across countries, the definition does differ a bit. 0.5 is, I believe, the most common, but I think it varies even from 0.0 all the way up maybe to like 1%, 1.5, or maybe even 2%. One of the countries has a pretty high alcohol by volume threshold for it.
Wow. That's pretty wide. And again, like I think like the context of like the accuracy matters a lot, right? Like if it's an extra 2% on a non-alcoholic beverage would be kind of almost defeating the purpose. But all right, well, so while we're on this topic of special populations, let's talk for a second about young people and kids. So what are the regulations right now around people under the age of 21 buying these products, the impact that smaller amount of alcohol has on their physiology, those sorts of things?
Yeah, so I'll start with what we know about the impact. Again, not a lot of research. This is an area really ripe for research across populations. Among youth consuming non-alcoholic beverages, I don't believe there have been any studies conducted in the US. There have been about three that I've been able to find conducted in Japan. And in those studies, surveying elementary, junior high school, and high school students, the rates of non-alcoholic beverage consumption in the past year were about 20 to 30% in the samples that they had. They also found that among elementary school students, non-alcoholic beverage consumption was associated with increased intention to use alcohol in the future. And among junior and high school students, non-alcoholic beverage consumption was associated with increased lifetime and past 30-day alcohol use. So there does seem to be this connection and potentially risk for alcohol use among people who are consuming non-alcoholic beverages. There was also a study conducted in Taiwan that found that exposure to marketing of non-alcoholic beverages on social media by influencers was associated with increased likelihood to consume non-alcoholic beverages. And again, that increased intention to consume or consumption was associated with increased intention to consume alcohol. So that kind of paints a picture. Well, four studies, we need more. But it starts to paint a picture that non-alcoholic beverages might be kind of an entry product to alcohol for youth. And that's something we don't want, right? That's not a good thing. And so for that reason, it would be ideal if there were regulations on limiting the potential for youth to purchase these products. So now I can pause there or I can get into the regulations. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, if we want to pause for just a second, I mean, I hear you talking about this, and I'm having like nightmare flashbacks to vaping right now, and thinking about like how that is another one of these products where there are some benefits, say from like a harm reduction standpoint, if someone was swapping entire, like we know now actually that doing both vaping and smoking at the same time has some worse outcomes than one or the other. But if you were totally swapping into vaping, you would be better off. But the byproduct of that has been like this whole new cohort of kids who've been now brought into nicotine who otherwise might not have been. Like, so I'm hearing that with these non-alcoholic beverages and being like, oh man, like is this just like a same song, different melody or something, like, oh man.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the parallel you're saying is spot on in some ways, right? Where for people who are already consuming alcohol, maybe these drinks can be helpful to transition off of alcohol. But for a population like kids, elementary schoolers who are probably not already consuming alcohol, to start them on non-alcoholic beverages might increase that likelihood of then transitioning to the full strength product. So yeah, there is concern there.
You know what? So what occurs to me about this too. So as long as we're drawing this comparison between like if we're looking at vaping and non-alcoholic beverages and maybe learning some lessons, I really appreciated the documentary on Netflix about vaping called B Big Vape, which really honed in on the beginning of Juul, and where things shifted, where things stopped being as much about harm reduction and started being more about making money. And there was this very clear marketing pivot where they instead of marketing with people who looked like 55-year-old chain smokers might, they marketed with people who looked like 18-year-olds and 20-year-olds having fun at parties. And one of the things that really stuck with me from that was just this question of like, when once you define a product, like once you have a product that's out there and you craft a story around it, in a narrative, like who uses it, why do they use it, what's it for? It seems like it's very difficult to shake that. And perhaps like that moment with vaping where things took a turn was when Juul pushed really hard for 6 to 8 months in social media to young people with young people. And then all of a sudden, flash forward 5 years, look where we still are right now. When I think about non-alcoholic beverages, I'm wondering that just would love your perspective or if there's any research on this. Have has the narrative around these beverages been defined? Like when folks are think about them from like a marketing perspective, do they think, oh, like this is like a harm reduction tool or a swap out tool? Like is this, I know you mentioned there's this marketing angle right now of addition rather than substitution, but do we have a feel for like, I don't even know what the predominant brands would be that are even marketing, or how are people seeing this?
Yeah, there's the substitution versus addition, but beyond that, we can think about like the use cases and the population. So in some cases, women are being targeted. In some cases, pregnant people are a targeted population. People who are like athletic after having a strong, intense exercise, grab a non-alcoholic beer is one way that it's been framed. Wellness and health, as opposed to having negative effects of alcohol. So those are some of the frames. I think what you're getting at is really important, where I don't think we're at the place where it has been marketed to kids. Anecdotally, I don't think these products at this point are very popular among teens and youth, at least in the US. But there's the risk for that to transition, right? If companies who are producing these products start to connect the dots, and maybe they already are, if they start to realize that they, in many cases, are permitted legally to sell to teens and start to market to them, I think there could be a shift towards that. And as you said, maybe it's too late at that point if it's already developed that image and then teens are hooked into it. And so this is a really important time for us to be thinking about how do we prevent that from happening if we do believe that these are a dangerous entry product, right? Not dangerous in and of themselves, but by creating risk for alcohol use, how can we get ahead of that? And that's where we go back to thinking about regulations.
Oh, man. So that's really profound. Like I think I felt like my stomach drop when you said like, because I don't know about the regulations when you were like, hey, they haven't done it yet, but maybe they still can. And that would be potentially really bad. It almost makes me feel like it thinks like this is like a precancerous node, right? Or some sort of thing where it's like, oh man, like this actually could, I mean, not that precancerous cells are good in any way, but like non-alcoholic beverages can have a place as a useful tool. But man, like if it makes that turn and starts being the new way kids are getting into alcohol early, and we start seeing that uptick in alcohol use the same way we've seen it with nicotine now. Oh man, what a, like, not only just a missed opportunity, but what a heap of trouble that we wouldn't have needed to have found ourselves in.
Right. And I don't mean to jump ahead of the data, right? Like I do think we need more evidence to suggest that there's a strong link, but at the same time, we don't want to wait for the evidence to a point where it's too late to make a prevention effort. Yeah. And so I guess one way for us to start thinking about this is looking at the regulations that exist. And so I took some time over the past year to really try to dig into this. And I contacted every alcohol regulatory authority across every state in the US to say, do you have a statewide policy about whether retailers are permitted to sell non-alcoholic beverages to people who are under 21? Because there's not a federal level policy. And by and large, states do not have statewide policies, meaning that legally at a state level, youth people under 21 are permitted to purchase these products. I will say individual retailers can make the choice to not sell. They can make the choice to ID. But I think the concern is if they start to realize that this is becoming a popular product, then they might be motivated by profits to sell. So that's where it might be useful to have kind of state level or even federal level policies prohibiting the purchase by teens.
Are you publishing that research anytime soon? Like, is that in?
It's under review. It's under review right now.
That would be a really, I think that's a really important, as someone who cares very much about drug policy and who looks at some of the things that are happening right now and seeing history repeat itself over and over again with public health problems, this feels like a moment where, you know, you can never prove a negative, but it feels like one of those moments where if we just put some guardrails up early, rather than having to like hope that this turns out differently, oh man, that would be huge. So incredibly useful. Wow, I can't wait to read that. How do we push this review process faster?
That's a great question. But no, I'll be happy to share that once, so if it gets accepted.
Yeah, but I guess just to reiterate, so what you found when calling these folks was that pretty much the majority of states, if you are under 21, there's nothing aside from a retailer or even a cashier's choice to sell to you that would stop you from buying something that is a that could have a small amount of alcohol, but we know is associated with future drinking behavior and intentions.
Correct. Yeah. I will say some
Okay.
entities said that there might be local ordinances, but I did not have the capacity to contact a local ordinance across all of the states. But yeah, on a state level, at least the majority do not have regulations limiting the retail, the sale of these products to people under 21.
Wow. Well, so you're like seeing me go through like my stages of action where first my stomach drops. I'm like, oh no. Then I'm like, but we can do something. So along those lines, I mean, from your perspective, if this is something, and I know a lot of listeners are, they care about policy. There's a lot of folks here who are in prevention who work with young people. Are there some steps, particularly prior to your study being released, which I think would be a very useful tool in terms of making this pitch? To policymakers locally, state, even federally, if this was something that folks were concerned about in terms of making it so that the kids couldn't just buy these products, are there suggestions that you have about who you could talk to or resources that we do have right now to help put some safeguards in place here in the short term?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think contacting local policymakers, state policymakers, federal policymakers, right, kind of at all levels would be useful if you're motivated to act on this. There's a group called the Scholars Strategy Network, who help take academic research and help academics inform policymakers, right? And just give them the data to help develop policies that are evidence-backed that can help prevent kind of some of the harms that we're talking about and others as well. So my thinking is maybe trying to connect with that group that I'm a part of and seeing what supports they could provide to, make some movement in this area so that we move towards prevention. But yeah, if people are interested, I'm more than happy to talk to them about this and maybe we brainstorm together about how we take some action.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, you got me all fired up now. Like, oh man, the ability to go upstream rather and be proactive rather than reactive. Like, sign me up. I love that. But
Absolutely.
all right. Well, we're almost at the end of our time for today. I don't know. Is there any? I've really appreciated all the information, all the science that you've shared today. The work that you personally are doing is fantastic, and I can't wait to see what's going to come out. Hopefully, in the next few months. But if you had to stick the landing, if you will, if you want to use a gymnastics term, and just leave something for our listeners in terms of just take homes around non-alcoholic beverages, what would you leave us with?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll echo some of the things that we've talked about, which are these beverages may be helpful for some people in reducing alcohol use, and they may be risky for others in terms of cueing craving and leading to alcohol use. And so, for people who are thinking about consuming these beverages or who are already consuming these beverages, I would just encourage kind of curiosity and reflection on the impact that they're having on your desire for alcohol, your alcohol consumption. And for providers who are working with people who maybe have struggled with alcohol use in the past, take that same curious approach. Because, yeah, as we've talked about, I think this is very individual specific, and it's important to just kind of reflect and have self-awareness about the impact of these products on your individual experience.
Well, I love that message, and something that I preach all the time is how we have to we really have to broaden our perspective and to think about like what works for an individual, their personal experience, their cultural experience, their background, even just their own bodies and how their bodies are working for them. And I'll always love talking with other psychologists who are trained in similar ways and who come with that perspective that just follow the science, and but more importantly, when science is based largely on groups and normal distributions, like listen to yourself, listen to your body.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Well, thank you again so much for coming on, and I'm sure we will be hearing more from you soon. And I know I will be reading your papers soon and pushing them out over social media.
Awesome. Thank you so much. This was really fun to talk about.
Thanks again to Dr. Molly Bodring for joining me on the show today, and as always, to you for listening in. If you'd like to get in touch with Dr. Bodring, you could reach her at bodring@stanford.edu. If you'd like to get in touch with me, feel free to visit my website at weinerphd.com or drop me a line at aaron@weinerphd.com anytime. Today's episode was written and produced by me, Aaron Weiner. Audio editing was provided by Lorenzo. Intro and outro music was composed by Atch. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll choose to join us again next time for Let's Talk. If you enjoyed today's show, make sure to subscribe to keep up to date on new episodes and to follow me on Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube to participate in new episodes as they air. Take care, and I look forward to our next conversation.